Okay, since we're a few minutes after, I'd like to open this session. I guess this is session two. Okay, this is session two. Session three of Sunstone Northwest. I'm always so happy to be home. I was raised in Yakima Valley, Washington, and it's always wonderful for me to come home, especially during the harvest season. And my name is Maxine Hanks. I'm chairing this wonderful panel about feminist theology in practice. And we have three young feminists here who are going to share some of their ideas and work about how they actually use feminist theology in their lives. And I'm going to add some comments at the end. Our panelists today are Sarah Staley Hanks, who blogs for Exponent 2. She lives close by in Renton and grew up in Southwest Utah. Sarah works with secondhand clothes for a living, and I can attest I've seen her designs online. So she's, if you want to remake your wardrobe or, you know, have her restyle you, she's the gal to talk to. She also teaches Relief Society in her ward, yay! And she's the happy co-caretaker of a cat named Walter. Natalie Hamilton Kelly blogs at Feminist Mormon Housewives. Natalie is right here, and Sarah's the gal in the middle. Natalie blogs at Feminist Mormon Housewives. I guess a few of you have heard of that, right? It's been going strong since, I think, 2005 or 2006. Natalie's married with two feline children and a low-wage job. She graduated with a BA from the University of Pennsylvania, and she's born in the church, studied history and African studies in college, and is writing her first novel. She also says that she's a Marxist feminist and anarcho-syndicalist. I'll let her explain what that is. I know what feminist and anarchist is, and Marxist, but I didn't get the last one. Our third panelist, Jenny Erigro Alderts, who's on the end, and who's a new mommy, expecting in a few months. Sorry, I just had to say that. She blogs for WAVE, and she does a whole lot of other things, too. She organizes projects at WAVE. She just recently celebrated the 10th anniversary of her baptism into the LDS Church, and she finds her home in the unorthodox Mormon community. She's a stay-at-home mom of two kids, with one on the way, and she's a wife to a UW PhD candidate. And that's a job in itself, I think, isn't it? And she's a part-time doula and midwifery student. And she also works on a lot of nonprofit organizations relating to women's health and maternal policy, like breastfeeding. I know that one. She founded the project Birthing in Zion, so you'll have to ask her what that's about. And I'm Maxine Hanks. I'm a feminist theologian in Salt Lake City, where I majored in gender studies at the U of U and have done grad work in religious studies and women's studies in religion at Harvard and elsewhere. I've been a guest lecturer at the U of U and several other universities in Utah. In fact, this quarter I'm guest lecturing on feminist theology at UVU. It's the first time we've got a feminist theology course at UVU. Yay! So a good friend of mine is teaching it, and I'm guest lecturing two sessions for her. I'm a chaplain, and I've been doing volunteer clergy and chaplain work at Holy Cross Chapel, which is Salt Lake Regional Medical Center in Salt Lake. Been there for 12 years. And what else do I want to say about myself? I was a fellow at Harvard for 1 year, and I have followed a Gnostic initiation path after my excommunication. I'll talk a little bit more about that today. Okay, we're going to start, and I'm going to let Sarah go first. I'm going to pass the mic to you, Sarah.
Should I stay seated or move?
Go ahead and go up there. I think that'd be great.
I just want to clarify that while I have worked with Exponent 2 on the reading and proofreading committees for the magazine, I'm actually not a blogger. I'm more of a blog admirer of theirs. So just so you're aware, I'm not asking me questions that I will not know the answers to. And I've got my words today on a phone, and I'm hoping that everything will work out with the technology on this. I was listening to an episode of This American Life recently, and listening to a segment about a man who had encountered a UFO 5 or 6 decades previously, and this segment was just about how his life had been affected by that. And the man said that he had never doubted that his experience really did happen, because there were other people who experienced it with him. He was one of six friends who had been present for the UFO encounter. And through the years, they had been able to support each other through all the judgmental looks and the small town gossip about how crazy they were. He never doubted what happened to him. He never doubted the reality of those white lights overhead, because he had other people to back him up and validate his experience. This is what I was afraid of. Okay, everything's gonna work out fine. So I found myself sort of relating to this man on the radio. He claims to have encountered something, but that something absolutely mystifies his neighbors and his family, because it's something that they just didn't see. And this encounter changed him in a profound way. That's sort of the way it is for me as a Mormon feminist. I come from a very straight-laced, true blue Mormon background, not only in terms of the family I grew up in and the family I married into, but also in terms of my personal choices. I was an intensely observant Mormon kid, and Mormonism has been central to a lot of my life's happiness. But at the same time, as a feminist and an idealist, I have encountered this set of things, this set of frustrations, polygamy, priesthood, temple covenants, Heavenly Mother, gender roles, family proclamation, imbalances of power, you know, all the things that we are so used to talking about and noticing. And I've encountered all of this, and this encounter of mine absolutely mystifies most of the people in my life, because they don't see the things that I see. But still, the encounter is real, and it's heavy. And just like the man on This American Life, I feel like I need some other people around me to say, hey, I saw the same thing you saw. I was there. It's real. The original way in which I have lived and applied Mormon feminism is by having consistent contact with other Mormon feminists. I don't need them to claim that title. I don't need them to believe all the same stuff I do. What I'm after in these friendships is an imprecise thing, but it's a sense that they are seeing the same stuff. They are seeing the gaps in gender treatment, and they're seeing the loaded language that we use in our meetings, and they're seeing the doctrinal inequity, and that they're not closing their eyes to make pretend that it's gone away. The first example of this comes from my best friend in the world. Her name is Chelsea, and she is someone like this, someone who sees the same things. We were college roommates who came to our feminist awakenings at roughly the same time, and I absolutely leaned on her to reassure me that I wasn't crazy or, on the other hand, evil for questioning the church's stance on things like same-sex marriage or priesthood or gender roles in family settings. She was my face-to-face, real-life support. Quantity-wise, though, I have found most of my Mormon feminist pals virtually on the internet. So thank you to Feminist Mormon Housewives, and thank you to LDS Wave. Thank you to Exponent 2 for facilitating that. I've participated on the reading and proofreading committees for Exponent 2, helping sift through submissions, helping to give the author some suggestions for revision, and checking final drafts. The production staff for Exponent 2 is made up of volunteers in classic Mormon style, and watching them try to fit in this extra calling on top of their callings as ward leaders and moms and employees and wives and friends is inspiring and utterly normal at the same time, because it's what I've always seen the Mormon women do in my life. I love the little ways that I have gotten to participate with Exponent, more as a devoted admirer than anything else. My dearest group of Mormon feminist friends has come through the podcast Daughters of Mormonism, headed up by a woman named Sybil and rounded out by a small but diverse group of Mormon women, including Miss Jenny here and myself. We are a small but close-knit clan. Sybil started Daughters of Mormonism just earlier this year in 2011 as a way for Mormon women to share their actual audible voices on subjects that range from temple attendance, temple garments, to sexuality, sex education, good girl syndrome, other things that have been really relevant in our lives. With the Daughters of Mormonism crowd, I'm in the odd position of being one of the more orthodox, one of the more traditional ladies. But no matter what our individual opinions are or our individual experiences, we are definitely saying to each other over and over again, yeah, that thing you see, I see it too. It's real, and you're not crazy for seeing it. One of my co-panelists from the podcast is named Jenny Brighton, and she did an episode that discussed paganism and Mormonism as two supportive belief systems in her life. And she spent a fair amount of time in that episode talking about symbols for the divine feminine. And what I took away from listening to that episode is that symbolic meaning can be a do-it-yourself undertaking. A symbol doesn't have to have anthropological evidence or historical significance in order to be personally meaningful. Jenny suggested that it might be a good idea to just decide on your own symbol for the divine feminine and just run with it. And as I listened, at that time in my life, I had been looking for ways to get acquainted with Heavenly Mother. And so I took Jenny's suggestion and I decided on arrows as my symbol for feminine and masculine harmony. Shortly after that, I was at the Provo Farmers Market and I purchased a ring for $10, and I'm wearing it today. When I put it on my finger a few minutes after buying it, I noticed that some of its patterns were reminiscent of arrowheads, with one pointing up and the other pointing down. And they also looked a little bit like hearts that you might draw to dot your eyes when you're a little girl, or when I was a little girl at least. And so because of the previous determination to see arrows as symbols, this ring took on an immediate significance as a sacred piece of jewelry for me. Not too different from my wedding ring or even from the temple garments that I wear as an endowed member of the church. Through a sequence of events that are really too boring to recount, I've acquired a second piece, which I'm also wearing, this copper bracelet that also has arrow imagery. And I've started to see anything that carries an aesthetic from the Southwest U.S. I don't know if you know exactly what I'm talking about, some of these tribal prints that are reminiscent of maybe Navajo patterns. I've started to see anything with that aesthetic also as a reminder of my Heavenly Mother's place and power alongside my Heavenly Father. So in this way, I live and apply Mormon feminism by appreciating symbolism and creating it when necessary. Instead of looking for symbols elsewhere, I try to carry the symbols on my own body when I get dressed in the morning. And they are probably significant only to me, but fortunately, I have decided that I matter enough to warrant that significance. Maxine asked each of us to talk about the topics in feminist theology that are most potent for us personally. And at this stage in my life, the answer to that is so easy and so instantaneous. It's all about Heavenly Mother for me. For some reason, all of the other Mormon feminist frustrations, as much as they have infuriated me at different times in my life, they feel really easy to overlook right now. And I don't know what that's about. It's as though all of my angst has been laser focused on this one topic. And perhaps it's because it's not just a topic. To me, it's about my mother, whom I do believe is real, and it's about a goddess who I do believe is out there. So with every Sunday and every general conference that passes by, I become more and more incensed at how little she is mentioned, and I become genuinely more confused, more mystified at how my fellow worshipers can say Heavenly Father so many times and not feel weird for not saying Heavenly Mother. At times, I really do feel like the disparity between the treatment of our Father in Heaven and our Mother in Heaven is actually driving me mad. And I feel strongly that I need a testimony of and a connection with my Heavenly Mother. I need it, and that's just it. That's all there is to it. I also need a testimony of and a connection with my Heavenly Father, but I've always had that. The church is very interested in facilitating that relationship, the one that I have with my Heavenly Father. And I want to say that I mean this sincerely. I am so grateful for that. I have two perfect eternal parents, and the church has helped me get to know one of them extraordinarily well. And that is not a small thing to me. But when it comes to my relationship with Heavenly Mother, the church doesn't seem to be interested at all in facilitating that or participating with that. I do find that frustrating, but I guess if I think of the church as an individual or as an agent unto itself, I guess that's its choice. That's its prerogative. If it doesn't want to be involved in my relationship with Heavenly Mother, then I guess that's their decision. And honestly, I feel that in my life, I've probably gotten too dependent on the church for my spiritual abundance. And so maybe it's best that I be a little more on my own in figuring out this relationship. But as I said, I do need that relationship with my Heavenly Mother. The church can be a part of that or not, but either way, I need to develop this. And if I have to do it on my own, then that's that. I think it's important for me to live my Mormon feminism by being exploratory and experimental with my faith. Things can't be safe and measured out all along the way. I can't count on getting all the knowledge I need from church-approved materials and Sunday meetings. I think feminism is generally at its best when it is encouraging the self-reliance that is implicit in adulthood and womanhood, and when it's giving the charge for a grown woman to say, I have this power, and I will exercise it, and I don't care who says that I can't. And that's how I'm trying to approach feminist theology, and particularly my understanding of Heavenly Mother. I'm trying to approach it as an adult who is in charge of her own testimony and is ready to mend the holes that are present in it. My husband served for 2 years in the France Paris mission, and I've gone to tag along with him to a handful of mission reunions. At the most recent one that I attended, I sort of shoved my way into a conversation that sounded interesting going on between a few of his old mission buddies. And one of them talked about an experience he had towards the end of his mission. He and the other departing missionaries sat down with the mission president's wife, and she gave a small French flag to each of the missionaries who were about to finish their service. She told them, you know, when you're back home, there are going to be times when you'll hear people say mean things about France. You'll hear them say that the French are all condescending snobs without morals, or that France is all sex and booze, or that Paris is a dirty city. And I hope that when those conversations come along, you'll speak up and you'll defend France. I hope that you'll say you love this country, if for no other reason than it was where you came to personally know your Savior, Jesus Christ. And that anecdote is something that occurs to me from time to time, and it reminds me of how I sometimes feel about the Mormon Church. This church, after all, is where I came to know my Savior. It's where I came to know my Father in heaven. It's where I learned that I was of infinite worth. And I'm always going to love the Mormon Church for that, even with all of its challenges. And I think I will also continue to have a reserve of hope for the Mormon Church. I see really good things in the future of Mormon feminism and feminist theology. I feel that we can accomplish great things. And it's not because we are great, but it's because the things that we're trying to accomplish are divine, and the cause of equality and the cause of justice matters. And we'll accomplish great things because the things themselves are great and they have to be accomplished. I feel that feminist theology has already made headway, if nowhere else, then at least in my own life, making me feel like I'm not crazy for seeing all of these gaps. I see some bright lights overhead, and I see some bright lights on the horizon when it comes to feminist theology and the way that men and women will come to understand themselves and each other in the Mormon Church. And all I'm hoping for is some other people who will say that they see that hope as well. Thank you.
Okay. Next, I guess, Natalie.
That was really awesome, Sarah. And I'm also relying on technology, so I'm hoping it also doesn't die on me. So when Maxine asked us to think of our most burning feminist issue, the first thing that always comes to mind for me... Do I need the microphone?
Yeah.
Okay. The first thing that always comes to mind for me is the temple. Because the temple is what launched my feminist awakening and is the thing that has given me the greatest psychological pitfalls and damage and everything. It just really, really threw me for a loop. But the temple's been talked about a ton in lots of places. I've written about it on my blog a lot, so I'm actually not going to talk about that today. But it's important to me as a feminist. The other thing that is important to me is something that is related to a lot of broader issues. I view feminism as one part of a movement that seeks to and racial oppression, sexist oppression, homophobic oppression. And I refer to this broadly as the class struggle or seeking for liberation. And I'm inspired by a really long history of people who have been involved in this struggle and the way that my own modern Mormon feminism fits into that today. So One thing that I want to think about regarding this feminism and how broad it can be for me is the way that the church tries to exert control over women's bodies. And thinking about how this control over women's bodies, this attempt to get control over women's bodies, is manifested in teachings like that in the proclamation, that men preside over the home and women nurture. And this is really important to me because it has ramifications far, far beyond the spiritual life of members to a lot of other realms of people's lives. So why does this pattern exist? What do these two things have to do with each other? What does controlling women's bodies have to do with the teaching that men preside and women nurture? And what does this all have to do with the modern day church and with this larger movement in history that I already talked about? And so I'm going to actually dip back into medieval history for a pattern. And I might get totally obscure and irrelevant, and I promise I'm going to try to tie it all together as long as Maxine doesn't cut me off and say I've run out of time. And I should mention that for a lot of this stuff about medieval history, I'm taking a lot of inspiration from an Italian author named Silvia Federici, who's a feminist Marxist who writes about peasant struggles in the Middle Ages. So a little historical background. At the end of the feudal era, at the end of feudalism in the Middle Ages, there were all these different competing forms of society that were trying to take shape, one of which was capitalism, which happened to be adopted by the ruling classes. The way that capitalism took shape is through a process of primitive accumulation. People gathering enough of something. You have to get something, get more of it than other people, so that you can use that something to get even more. And the first two things that were generally enclosed were land and labor. And these two things went hand in hand in the way they were enclosed. So throughout Europe, in the Middle Ages, there was at the end of the Middle Ages, there was this process called the enclosure movement, where land that had previously been designated as commons, where everybody could go to farm to grow food, to raise their livestock, to hunt, to fish, common land that everybody had access to, the king would grant a charter to one family or one person and say, you now privately own this land. And that land would be closed off. They would build hedges around it, they would build walls, dig ditches, something to actually physically designate this land as the private property of other people. And instead of growing food, it would be used to graze sheep so that they could get wool to sell for a lot of money. So they enclosed all this land. Meanwhile, there had been all these people living on this land, and these people were kicked off the land. They could no longer grow their own food, so they were forced to wander to cities, to beg, to work for the people who'd kicked them off their land. They suddenly needed this thing called money to buy food because they couldn't grow it for themselves anymore. So that's sort of the birthright of capitalism. That's sort of how this all took place and came to be. And there were two really big threats to this process because it was a struggle to get this thing imposed on society. So two of those big threats, first was just that there was a lot of militant resistance to the whole damn thing. People didn't just want to accept this. And second was the threat that this huge body of workers that made this possible might not be reproduced, that we might, you know, there might be another black plague, we might run out of people. Or there might not be enough of them that they have to do whatever we say. So first, pretty simple, lots of people were really pissed off about this whole losing their land and their community and their livelihood business, and they didn't just take it lying down. Rebellions, uprisings, and revolutions were a constant feature of life during this period from the transition to feudalism to capitalism. And women were really crucial, powerful leaders in widespread rebellion across society. Women provided crucial leadership and instigated a lot of rebellions. They weren't considered people under the laws, so they could break the laws. They could go out in the night with their children and fill in the ditches that were cutting them off from the land. They could break down the walls and pull up the hedges and physically take back land that had been stolen. They could board ships that were leaving to go to the new colonies and steal the food back for the starving people that were waiting at the docks. So women led, leading this huge resistance that involved so many people. And the second problem was this problem that we might not have enough people to carry out this great project that required so much labor. Because women might decide to control their own sexuality, might decide to control their own offspring, and refuse to contribute to the labor needs of rising capital. So first, the women needed to get control of women's bodies and the reproduction of human life, which meant that they'd have control of the labor force. So the first official Catholic teachings about homosexuality appear in this era. Rape was decriminalized in some areas. there are all these new categories of people who need to be regulated. A man who has sex with men instead of women, heterosexual couples who engage in non-procreative sex, women who decide freely when and with whom to have sex. These are all suddenly forbidden by the church and the state. This is when all those teachings start to come out. And then, of course, healers and midwives and wise women who knew how to prevent pregnancy or how to induce abortion, all these were really big threats to the power structure. So you have women leading rebellions and able to control the reproduction of labor. And so the response to this is that women who are rebellious, women who are assertive, women who have specialized knowledge about pregnancy or childbirth or abortion, are attacked. And this took place through the witch hunt, wherein, you know, a genocide against women was begun, and just so many women were killed in really violent, horrible ways. One way that the Italian author Federici talks about is how women would be placed on a seat of iron metal with a fire underneath it, so that they would slowly melt to death, all in front of a community gathering with their daughters placed right in front row to watch the whole thing. So you can imagine the way that that would quell women's resistance and the strength and ability of women to really resist. And it also, because if you kill all the women who have specialized knowledge about childbirth, you destroy that knowledge. So this did a couple of things. It helped to demonize women in general. Women became something to be feared, something that was of the devil, something that was tempting. And this process helped men identify by gender rather than by class. So they wanted to side with the men who were oppressing them rather than the women who they'd previously fought with, because those women might be witches who might steal their penises in the night and feed their children to the devil. Anything can happen. So specialized knowledge was destroyed, and this class solidarity that really threatened capitalism was undermined. So both problems presented by the rise of capitalism were addressed by gaining control over women's bodies. And out of this, we see modern Victorian womanhood, the sense of what womanhood is now, come out of this whole process. So women now, if you're a good woman, you're pure, you're asexual, you just love the domestic sphere, you want to be submissive. That whole cult of Victorian womanhood that we still live with a lot today just came through this whole process. So I promise this is all relevant to modern day LDS feminist theology. The LDS church in its history really definitely obviously needed to control reproduction. We see at the beginning of the church, polygamy, one of the most extreme things you can do to make sure that you are ensuring reproduction. We needed more people. We needed big families. We needed to get this little tiny group that was really persecuted to be a whole heck of a lot bigger if we had any chance of surviving. So pick men who are really invested in the church, who are the strong leaders, who you know are loyal, and get them to impregnate as many women as possible so that those children will be raised to be really loyal to the church and the church will grow. You know, raising up a righteous seed, that's the Book of Mormon states that that's the only time when polygamy is okay, is if you want to raise up a righteous seed unto the Lord. Just grow your numbers. This guaranteed that the church would be able to survive. So how does this manifest today? We ended polygamy. So the way that the church controls women's bodies has changed. Polygamy's gone, but members for a very long time were still taught that they should have as big a family as they possibly could. Some would say that that's still taught today. Birth control has been explicitly banned, was explicitly banned, and in some local areas, depending on the leadership, the male leadership might still be. And then there are all these institutional measures to encourage marriage as early as possible and to get as many children as possible. The Young Women's Program has an obscene focus on getting married, just all the time. At the age of 18, you can join a singles ward where there's an obscene focus on getting married all the time. And there's even a later mission age for women, because women are more valuable for growing the church as mothers than they are as missionaries. Because raising up children to be in the church is a lot more effective way to grow the church than sending out people to knock on doors. So we have this system where women do endless amounts of unpaid, it's a word I usually read and don't say, endless unpaid reproductive labor, birthing, raising, and teaching children, and keeping the home functioning, which enables their husbands to be full participants in both the world and in the church. So this guarantees the long-term vitality of the church, because women are going to make sure the home front's okay, they're going to keep raising up the next generation of members, while men get to run the institution. And of course, women also devote a lot of long hours to running the institution, but even our roles within the church are usually those about reproducing the labor force, or the membership, in the case of a church. We are in charge of the primary. We're in charge of taking care of homes, of helping people who are sick. And my last three enrichment activities in my ward have been about canning, how to eat healthy food, and how to get your home organized, which are great activities, but not gender-specific. And they're all about keeping the home organized and women taking charge of that so that men can be free to take part in the wider world and the church. How am I on time?
Two more minutes.
Okay, then I'm going to skip.
Yeah.
I was going to talk a little bit about... okay, so the consequences of this are really big. First of all, it explains the church's need to really speak out against homosexuality, just like the Catholic Church did in the time when they needed more laborers. And it also predicts and guarantees the endless focus on women's bodies, about how many earrings we can have, how much of our shoulder we can show, and, you know, reaching into larger society, how much leg hair we can have, what kind of clothing we can wear, all of these things. And this has a lot of really devastating consequences. When women don't focus on making sure that they can provide for themselves economically in the future, they have to rely on a fairy tale that they'll have a husband who can take care of them for their whole life. Obviously, sometimes this fairy tale doesn't work out. A woman's husband might die or become disabled. They might get divorced. She might never get married. She might want to marry a woman. They face a lot of serious harm, and this economic dependence can keep them trapped in an abusive marriage. If they are not in a situation of marriage, this economic dependence and this lack of cultivation of their self can keep them trapped in an abusive job. So I was going to talk about a little bit of my mother's own story here, but I'm going to skip that because I'm running out of time. Simultaneously, women are, you know, not being enabled to empower themselves, while men are facing overwhelming pressure to provide single-handedly for a whole family. So it's steadily pushing men, without virtually any other choice, to take part in this oppressive wage labor capitalist system. So religion thus reinforces the interests of the ruling class, fulfilling Marx's prophecy that the ideology of the ruling class is the ruling ideology. Religion's one of the most effective ways that this can happen, but religion's also one of the most effective ways that this process can be fought. And that's why feminist theology is important to me. So that's how I live my feminist theology. For me, it means a lot more than... It involves it's the movement. It's the class struggle. And I'm a feminist Marxist, anarcho-syndicalist, which is a reference to communism by labor unions instead of government. So how do I live my feminist theology? I stay in and I stay loud. Women have a capacity for birthing a lot more than just babies. They've given life to revolution across geography and throughout history. The militant and nonviolent uprising in Egypt was kicked off by a young woman. In the French Revolution, women were a huge source of inspiration and creativity. And medieval women were powerful enough to become the focus of oppression. More and feminists today can follow in these revolutionary footsteps. We can live our theology, and we do that in a lot of ways, which I think Sarah talked about really beautifully, a lot of ways we can do that. I blog for Feminist Mormon Housewives. And for me, FMH is a place where I have found my online home, and it's one of the ways that this is being accomplished. FMH is a center. It's not a place where we are, it's not Sunstone. We don't put out all these like academic articles and groundbreaking new theories. It's home base. It's where people can come to be told, I hear you, I see these things too. It's where women have been educated, comforted, radicalized. It's a home base for the grassroots movement that is popularizing the feminist critique of the church. It's where people who are involved in the battle can come to sip some tea, to share some laughs, to rest, and to be rejuvenated so that they can carry on the good fight. Women and men have worked really hard to eliminate the damaging teachings over time about gender in the church, and they've been really successful at softening those blows and forcing the power structure to come up with different lines and different explanations. But there's still this fundamental lie that women's bodies need to be controlled. And each new iteration of this lie comes with a trickle of more freedom and a little less rigidity, but the lie is still undeniably alive, and it shapes lives in a very real way today. And until that lie is fully exposed and turned down, it's going to continue harming men and women. So looking to feminist theology in the future, I just think if my somewhat maybe obscure definition of feminist theology is enacted, I don't see how the church as it is today can continue to exist, which is, I think, what somebody said in the last session. The church cannot be the same if it embraces feminist theology, and I think that's a good thing.
Okay, Jenny. I'll hand the microphone to Jenny. Is this still on? Oh, good.
While my colleagues might have relied on technology, I'm going to rely on the ancient Hawaiian art of talk story. I have no paper. And with that, I feel like I should start with a great big aloha!
Aloha! Aloha.
Thank you. So as Maxine said, this last week, I believe it was Thursday, I celebrated my 10-year anniversary of my baptism. And I sang myself a song. I sang Happy Rebirthday to Me. And we had a special time. It was fun. And in that 10 years, I have changed dramatically. And part of my path has been to embrace feminist theology. My story before being Mormon was that I was Unitarian Universalist. And so I was raised feminist. I was raised liberal. I was raised to value social justice. And so when I joined the church, those were the values that I was so happy to find in a Christian religion. I was so, so very pleased to find that my Unitarian self could find a home as a Christian. And that some of the pitfalls that I perceived in mainstream Christianity and Protestantism were addressed. Part of that was Heavenly Mother, was knowing that there is a Mother in Heaven that is equal in power and might, in glory and beauty and goodness to our Father. And I felt like I was home. And then I learned a little bit about Mormon women history. And I wondered if I could still be home in this church. I cannot describe the betrayal that I felt learning about the history of women giving blessings, women being ministers, women just having so much autonomy over their organization, women as midwives. Midwives were a calling in the church, and part of it definitely relates to what Natalie was saying. But there's also a beauty and a power of women supporting women in childbirth in the sacredness of bringing forth life and the especially the power that comes when it is chosen of a woman for her own self, and that we have a very, very rich history of midwifery in the world. And I'm so glad Natalie brought it up. That today, what I'm planning to be and what I'm working towards would have gotten me a horrific death. So I come to Mormonism embracing my inner witch. And I find a home here. How ironic. And that's the basis of the project Birthing in Zion. Birthing in Zion is based on this idea that there used to be a midwife in every stake and every ward of the church, that women were, that was the profession, that was a very valid profession for women throughout history, and that was taken away from us through the patriarchalization, is that a word, of maternity care. And it moved to hospitals, and the knowledge moved to men, and women, even in early America, were villainized. And you got some of that witch language coming back again as there was an effort to put birth in the hands of man. And so birthing in Zion is a way to kind of subvert that, to bring all of those LDS women who have felt that calling, who no longer are extended it through their church, through an institution. It was actually considered analogous to patriarch to be the midwife. And so now we're bringing it back. It may not be a calling that a woman is extended, but it is one that she may embrace through how the Spirit leads her in her own life. And we are collecting names and contact information of midwives around the church, including doulas, which is the now professional career choice of women who used to attend the births of their family, friends, sisters, nieces, nieces, and as just community members, they were the women who were there, who were the support for women who were giving birth. And so we have that. It launched 2 weeks ago, and we have had a tremendous response. It's really like that community is coming back together. And it doesn't need to be institutionalized. It doesn't need to be a calling in the church for that power to still be there. And I'm very glad that there was such a great response. So that's one way that I live my feminist theology, most certainly. The other is through my involvement with LDS WAVE. WAVE stands for Women Advocating for Voice and Equality. And that I came to through partly my Unitarian upbringing, but also through BYU training me to be an activist. I have been involved in studying family policy and ways in which we can promote social justice and alleviate oppression and to encourage freedom and equality for the sexes and for all classes of people through family education and family structure, family dynamics. And so my vision for WAVE and my role with them is as the Women's Service Mission Director. Tie this part in. So before I joined the church, I was going to be Unitarian minister. I was going to be, that was my plan. I grew up in Central Valley, California. I was going to go to Star King in Berkeley. I was going to follow in the paths of five generations of my family as Berkeley graduates. And that was what I was going to do. And I was going to lead a congregation. And I was going to be a female leader and of these topics that I'm so very passionate about. And then I became Mormon, and it's like it stopped. There was a halt, and I could no longer pursue the path that I wanted for myself. And I tried to content myself, oh, well, you know, it's a lay clergy. Like, that's great. I'll be able to speak in church, and I'll be able to give lessons, and I'll be a teacher, and I will still have a role as a theologian in my community. I found it frustrating, mildly. One of the things I wanted to do is back when there were enrichment groups, when women were told that, you know, if there's an interest in your ward and you would like to create a group around this interest and do something about it, go for it. And the group that I wanted to do was community involvement and activism. And it was very soon after that enrichment groups were done away with. And I felt like, well, where is my institutional outlet? Where is my social justice committee among Mormons? And that is where I found it. I made it. I put it in WAVE as a Women's Service Mission Director. And I'm very, very grateful for my colleagues for seeing that feminist Mormon theology connects to feminist issues on a worldwide level. And it connects to social justice and a need to really address some issues that have been going on for centuries of our history. And through the Women's Service Mission, I've been exploring innovative ways for family structure to allow for the freedom of women to be leaders, to be actively involved in the careers of their choice, and to have as many children as they would like or as few as children as they would like. I am a proponent of equally shared parenting, a concept where it would actually have to completely restructure our economic system and do away with a 40-hour work week for the majority of people so that they could share the family responsibilities, about part-time work for fathers, part-time work for mothers, where both would have equal time or about equal time with their children, providing child care, nurturing, and being present in the home and involved, while the other is breadwinning and pursuing their academic, intellectual interests through their careers. And it's something that there are parents in our world, in the United States, that are living this today, and they find economic barriers to do this. It is, but they're doing the best they can. It's one of those things. We can't wait for things to change for us to do the things how we want to do it. We have to go ahead and do it the best as we can, given the constraints of our system, and show people that it can be done, and say, hey, there are better and easier ways of doing this. Let's make it happen. So that's part of it. And then I also realized that some of these things are privilege. This is privilege talking, saying that women should, white Mormon women on the American continent should have the freedom to do these things. And so I also have a tremendous focus on global poverty and how this is an issue that has to be addressed. And it will be just like the women who have led the uprisings in Egypt, it will be something that women lead. Women will be the leaders of this economic struggle for fairness and equity for all classes.
About 1 minute.
Okay.
You want to summarize?
And so that's my feminist theology. The issues that matter most to me are women autonomy.
What happened? It went away. Try this.
Okay.
Testing.
So I've mentioned basically all of the threads that women as fully endowed people capable of choosing for themselves what they would like to do for their lives, to be leaders in their church, in their world, in their families. And so that ministry in the church is a very large, it's a big issue for me. I would really like to see the day brought back when we no longer feel like we're apostates if we are giving blessings and healing and anointing women and other and men of the church the way it was done. I want to see it back. It doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be priesthood. I have such tremendous respect for our foremothers, but I would like to see women be more involved in the leadership on all levels. I would like to see Heavenly Mother included. I share the frustration with Sarah that every time I hear Heavenly Father, it's like it's being pounded in my head that I need to hear Mother included with him. And I see that this future is happening. One of the places where we see it happening is with Blog, with Your Mutual Approbation. A LDS woman is on a daily basis posting a scripture that regenders the references to God to include goddess. And she also includes making sure that women are included in the scriptures. We see progress being made. We have collaborations between WAVE and Feminist Mormon Housewives and Exponent to take on some of these issues and to faithfully propose to leaders of the church ways that women can be actively involved in the community and not feel some of these frustrations that do exist. So I will wrap up with that. Thank you.
Oh, just clip it? Okay.
There we go.
So I can do this.
I don't know. Maybe I'll just hold it. I really want to thank Sarah and Jenny and Natalie for their comments. I think they've done a great job of talking about how women have traditionally, historically, and currently found ways to find their own power and ministry and place by claiming their own personhood and their own responsibility within the settings and limitations that they have, but also going outside of those. But women claiming that adulthood and that responsibility. So I think you've all done a good job of articulating a variety of ways. I wanted to talk a little bit about finding hope and looking at the positive, looking at what you do have rather than what you don't have. I would have to say that in my work as a feminist theologian and in my first book about feminist theology, Women and Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism, and in my excommunication for that book, for publishing and doing feminist theology, and in my work since then as on a Gnostic path of an initiation, I've always had to focus on what I do have, what I can find within the scriptures, the systems, the structures, and stay focused on that. And so I wanted to offer some ideas today and maybe some hope and share a few ideas that I hope will give women encouragement and maybe inspire men and women about the things that can be done within the structures and systems. There are lots of ways that women can exercise and practice feminist theology within the limitations of Mormon church and religion. And in fact, I would say most of it is there. We just have to look for the ways. Interestingly, I wanted to note one parallel. In early Christianity, Mormonism is actually, in many ways, far more progressive and far more ahead of things than a lot of other religions. In early Christianity, they had lost the divine feminine. She wasn't there. The Catholics sort of held on to her through Mary, but you have to look to the Gnostics to find the divine feminine in early Christianity, and it's the Gnostics who were celebrating her and working with her, and also the Gnostics as well as the Pauline Christians who were allowing women to function as equal servants and deacons and bishops. In contemporary Christianity, you have to look to the Mormons to find, like the Gnostics in early Christianity, the Mormons are the ones who have the divine feminine. Most Christian churches who follow the traditional Trinity or the Nicene Creed don't have a divine feminine in their faith, unless you look to the Quakers or more New Age Christian churches. So the Mormons are unique in that way, and she is there very much, along with the masculine trinity. I would say in my book, Women in Authority, what I did was interviewed a lot of women about how they envision the divine feminine. Do they experience her in their lives? How do they experience her? And I asked men and women to create descriptions of the divine feminine, which they did, and I compiled them and published them in the book. That was the most revolutionary chapter in the book, which the church didn't notice. They focused more on Michael Quinn's essay. But that chapter of personal discourse on the divine feminine is really quite progressive. If you take a look at it, it's online at Signature Books Library. But how can women today experience and practice their relationship with the divine feminine within the limits of the LDS Church? It's not about rights or privileges as much as it is about relationship. Do you really have a relationship? It's really about cultivating the relationship. I like to talk about the outer versus the inner. Outer authority, which is priesthood, social approval, permission, position, versus inner, which is the power of God. And of course, Mormonism defines priesthood as the power of God, which is really hearkening to the inner aspect of priesthood. Ideally, the two ought to coincide, both outer and inner. Really, if your ordination is not inner, if it's not spiritual, you really don't have one, I don't think. It's sort of inner or not at all. Ideally, they should coincide so that you've got an inner connection to the divine and you are practicing on behalf of your community. But the inner is what has to happen first. And so Mormon women already have a direct access to that. And in fact, that's what really has to happen in I think, a person's spiritual development, especially if you are in a tradition that does allow priesthood, as with the one I went into. So I think that cultivating that relationship with the divine and expressing it and feeling it and beginning to open yourself to that power, when you have the inner ordination or the power of God, which is priesthood, it changes you and your life, and it affects people around you. It enables you to heal and bless and transform reality. And I think that's where the real power is, regardless of whether you have outer permission or not. And in fact, you can transmute and transform circumstances and relationships through that spiritual power, which can then affect the outer organization. So I think it's the place to work anyway. So with the Divine Feminine, I would really encourage women to cultivate that relationship privately, since that's really where it is anyway. With priesthood, in my book, I outlined four ways, in the introduction to Women in Authority, four ways that Mormon women received priesthood during the first 30 years, from 1830 to 1850. Through the gifts of the Spirit and those ministrations in Kirtland period, which really, I've done research on where that came from, and some of it came from Stone Campbellite movement and Sidney Rigdon's congregation. Those women brought it in with them, which is a whole interesting topic by itself. But then there's the Relief Society in 1842, which was, of course, ordained, devised to be a kingdom of priests that would move according to the ancient priesthood in Enoch's day and Noah's day. And you can go online now. This is a positive sign. The Relief Society minutes are up online as part of the Joseph Smith Papers. Go to the Joseph Smith Papers, look at minutes, bring up the Relief Society minutes. Jill Durk has spent years, I've been waiting 7 years for this to happen, so that I could link them into our BYU site. And the actual pages are there, and with the actual typescript of the writing. And I encourage you to go and look, because there's a very interesting reference right on the first page, which is really a Masonic reference. But again, it harkens to the way that the Relief Society is connected to Masonic influences. I won't say any more, but you can go online and see for the first time the actual words, the powers, the keys, the authorities that were given to the Relief Society, which have been obscured and hidden, and now are there available for everyone to see. You can see those quotes where Joseph Smith does, in fact, acknowledge the Relief Society as a quorum, a female quorum, equal in status to the male quorums. In 1843, you have the Holy Endowment. So women and men received together the order of priesthood in the temple through the temple ceremony, which again is a really important aspect of priesthood, which Michael Quinn talks about extensively in my book, Women in Authority. And then fourth, in 1850, you have the setting apart and ordination to missionary. A missionary is a ministerial role. And so when Louisa Barnes Pratt was set apart and anointed to serve a full-time mission, she was also given a vial of oil that she could use. Brigham Young gave it to her and told her to perform blessings, including with the oil. So those are just four ways that women received priesthood. But again, and so those are ways that women today can tap into women in the church through Relief Society and through the gifts of the Spirit. I want to mention a couple of other ideas. There are ways that women also have priesthood roles in Mormonism without the ordination. A priesthood role where you're occupying a position or you have a calling or a duty that's very similar to priesthood. The act of teaching, being a teacher of a course, back in the early days of the United States, in the early history of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Anne Hutchinson was kicked out for teaching and expounding on the scriptures. She was a famous feminist heretic. That itself was seen as the role only of a minister, the elders of the group. So being a teacher to expound the scriptures, which also Emma Smith is exhorted to do in the Doctrine and Covenants, she is told that she's given the authority to teach and expound on the scriptures. That is a ministerial position. Anytime you preside over any kind of service, even if it's a non-ordinance service, so if you're presiding over a meeting, you are acting in the role of a minister. Chaplaincy is something that Mormon women can do, and chaplaincy is a ministry. It's a form of ministry. There are more and more Mormon women who are taking chaplain training and certifying as chaplains. Also, setting apart, when you're set apart to any office, the term that they use is setting apart, but it's really an ordination. In the early church, the term was ordination, and they changed. For example, when Emma was called and set apart, she was ordained to lead the Relief Society. So setting apart isn't an ordination, but we're just using a different term. So you're ordained to that particular calling. Interestingly, when I attended the Claremont Conference on Feminist Theology back in March 2009, Kate Holbrook gave a paper about women with a bishopric. And Kate Holbrook was out at Harvard when I was out there. She's now in Salt Lake finishing her dissertation. She talked about ways that Mormon women have a kind of bishopric. And this is something that I've looked at as well and talked about as well, because a bishop is an overseer. The bishop or the episcopos means overseer of a household of faith. So in the New Testament concept of bishop, it means that you oversee or manage a household of faith. And women do this all the time. Mormon women do this all the time. There are many applications of this. In fact, I see these women like Lisa at Feminist Mormon Housewives and Trissa at WAVE and these young women who are managing and overseeing a whole community as a kind of bishop. In the early Christian church, the churches were house churches. People met at homes. And the bishop was just simply the owner of the house who welcomed the community into his home. And the deacons were his servants, diakonos, servant, were the people who served the meal, his servants. So the bishop and deacon of the early house churches were simply the host and their servants. And women held those roles. In early Christianity, women were, you have Lydia, who her whole household was converted, and she invited the brethren, and they had church meetings in her home. Lydia is seen as a bishop, an early bishop in Christianity. And there are a number of references to others. For example, Phoebe, who is a servant or a diakonos of the church in Chancerea, that's mentioned in Romans 16. You also have Priscilla, who we can't tell if she was a bishop, deacon, or exactly what, but she was cited by Paul as a fellow worker in the church. There are numerous examples. When I was excommunicated from Mormonism, I went to early Christianity to try to find myself. And I went to study the New Testament and also the Gnostic Christians to try to find precedent and place for myself, and discovered that not only that women held those positions and that a servant, a deacon, is simply a servant. Any kind of servant or minister or deacon or bishop is someone who serves the church. And I found myself coordinating and mentoring other people, both in Mormonism, Mormon studies, and feminist Mormonism, but also at chapel when various independents would come looking for a place. And I found myself on this path, the inner path of inner ordination, and overseeing or functioning like an inner bishop to help and mentor people on this path. I really have found myself coming full circle, and this will sound strange to people, I'm sure, but I found myself overlapping with Relief Society President Julie Beck on a number of issues. We've come at these from opposite approaches, but I have found myself coming home to the power and the notion of the gifts of the Spirit and the inner ordination and the power to serve, that a ministry is your position of serving and your power to serve. Your ability to connect with the divine light in other people and help to open that for them, and your ability to transform reality with that divine that mirrors between you and them. I want to mention one more thing that I found really interesting. Julie Beck gave a talk a year ago in General Conference in April 2010, which she reiterated at BYU and also at BYU in April 2010, and then again in May of this year, she reiterated again. And her talk was about the power of the Relief Society, the power and the responsibility of women in the Relief Society, the power that they have to receive the Spirit, the gifts of the Spirit, the power that they have to manage and control and oversee their homes. And she also talked about the power of God within them. What I found interesting about her talk, which was entitled, "And Upon the Handmaids in Those Days Will I Pour Out My Spirit," she talks about women or mothers as the lioness at the gates of home. And then she goes on, she uses this metaphor of the lioness as a responsibility, but also she's talking about the mom being the overseer of the home, which is a kind of bishop. She also talks a lot about their need and responsibility for personal revelation. She says, as they seek personal revelation, the Lord will pour out his Spirit upon his handmaids. And the ability to qualify for and receive personal revelation is the single most important skill that can be acquired in this life. See, I agree with that. I think that's really interesting. In her talk, I want to mention that she does talk about motherhood and what I have called compulsory motherhood, which harkens back to what Natalie was talking about. But in her talk, you see both. You see this rhetoric of compulsory motherhood along with a rhetoric of the spiritual power of women and their ability to receive revelation and to manage their sphere. That notion of compulsory motherhood comes out of the 1700s. It was Republican motherhood. In the early U.S., women were expected to have children and raise up good children for the Republic, hence the term Republican motherhood. And it is a kind of notion that you are expected by the society to produce and raise children. That notion did find its way into Mormonism, along with these other incredibly liberating notions of the divine feminine and women having priesthood and the Relief Society being essentially like a Masonic female order. So in Mormonism, you have these tendencies side by side, and I see them in Julie Beck's talk. So I like to focus on the messages of empowerment, and I just want to read a few more before I close. She says, the female identity we have from Heavenly Father can be fully understood only through spiritual confirmation. An intellectual study can be made, but the spiritual confirmation teaches us who we are and what we can do. Women are given a powerful, influential leadership role. The responsibility of being a wife, mother, grandmother, daughter, sister, and friend is actually about nurturing, teaching, teaching and influencing. The priesthood is God's power. It is his power to create, to bless, to lead, and to serve as he does. See right there, she's talking about the spiritual notion of priesthood as the power of God, which women have. She also is very careful to say, don't confuse the power of the priesthood with the keys and offices of the priesthood. The power of the priesthood is limitless and is shared with those who make and keep covenants. So she's, I think, getting at something that I think is really powerful. The notion that women have access to the inner, what I would call the inner priesthood. I have a tendency to view Mormonism as having preserved the notion of outer priesthood and inner priesthood in the male quorums and the Relief Society. I would hope that, again, as it should be in any ministry, the two would coincide. Who knows? That may happen. But for now, I think the Relief Society is embodying the inner priesthood. And I would encourage women to fully realize what we do have, because it will change lives. And on a parting, my last thought, I want to say the title of Julie Beck's talk, "And Upon the Handmaids in Those Days Will I Pour Out My Spirit," comes from, I looked it up, but it comes from Acts. And if you read the whole passage, it's quite revealing, because it has to do with the office of a prophet in early Christianity. The gifts of the Holy Spirit includes prophecy. Here's the text, the full text, from which she chose the title of her talk. "And it shall come to pass in the last days, says God, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your young men shall see visions. Your old men shall dream dreams. And on my men servants and on my maid servants, I will pour out my spirit in those days, and they shall prophesy." So, that last phrase, I would have loved to have seen her attach that to the end of the title of her talk. Anyway, I wanted to share those ideas with you, and I'd like to turn it now over for discussion, for question and answer. Go ahead, Bill.
When you consider the leadership roles that women played in the very early church, and isn't it curious that the so-called Restoration established instead a high degree of patriarchy, when one might be able to say that the apostasy was taking the women out in the first place?
Mm. That's a great point. I tend to think, as being, I've often said I went from being a Gnostic Mormon to a Mormon Gnostic, but I tend to see that, I tend to agree with Mormonism's view of the apostasy, but also the Gnostic view, which are kind of the same, which is that by the Nicene Council, things had shifted drastically, and the church fathers had drumming out the role of women. I mean, I see that as the central feature of the apostasy, the loss of the divine feminine and the loss of women's place as bishops, prophets, deacons, teachers, presbyters. So, but Mormonism preserves a number of amazing qualities from early Christianity, not just Gnostic Christianity, but also Jewish Christianity, Gnostic Christianity, and Pauline Christianity. Mormonism does contain aspects of all three of those movements of early Christianity, including the very simple notion of a house church with a bishop at the head. Every congregation in Mormonism has a bishop. So the household of faith is this, you know, your ward, your house, with a bishop at the head. So I really see both. I mean, I really see the strands of empowerment there, along with rhetoric of disempowerment that has to sort itself out. So, and do you have questions for our wonderfully unfinished Brent?
Question for Natalie. What efforts are being made to try and educate some of the men in the church on this? The reason why I mention this is I saw Mitt Romney was on with Mike Huckabee, and he took the pledge to agree that life begins at conception, right? Then in a town hall meeting shortly after that, he was asked by a woman in the audience, "Why are you against birth control?" And he said, "Simple answer, I'm not." And she said, "Well, Yes, you are. If you believe that that life begins at conception, then 90% or more of hormonal contraception are thrown out, because one of the things that they do is that if, by any chance, an egg becomes fertilized, it will stop it from being implanted. And he was completely mystified. You could tell he had what she was even talking about. So that's a case where I think if he had been educated, that discussion with Mike Huckabee may have gone differently.
Should I reiterate Brent's question on the mic?
Yeah. So I'd be kind of curious as to what efforts are being made to try and educate people on
the... Should I reiterate the question? Brent just suggested that when Mitt Romney was challenged, he was challenged about the issue of abortion and when the spirit enters the body, and that if he'd had more education regarding that, that he wouldn't have been so mystified.
And specifically contraception.
Specifically contraception. If Mitt had a little more education about that. Okay. Who wanted to respond to that, Jenny?
You had asked Natalie, but Wave is the action end of the feminist community. And we have action that is planned in the works on topics like this. This coming year, you will see what we are calling topical guides on topics of feminism. And we have various topics that each guide is going to basically be an outline that provides education to priesthood leaders and the general membership of the church on these topics from a feminist perspective. And I we haven't added contraception to the list, but that needs to be on there.
Natalie, you want to mention something?
Yeah, what I would also say is, who cares what Mitt Romney thinks about it? I'm a lot more excited about the fact that that woman was educated about contraception, that she understood the process. That's how women are going to take their power. It's not by letting the men understand us who are in power and then granting us the authority to live the way we want to live. It's by living the way we want to live. And, I mean, Mitt Romney doesn't, he's the 1%. The education of the oppressors is incidental to the movement for liberation. And I classify Mitt Romney in that category.
That reminds me of a great... One of the things that you're seeing here is the difference in generational feminism. It reminds me of, in the suffrage movement, the difference between Carrie Chapman Catt and Alice Paul. These are the Alice Pauls, and I'm the Carrie Chapman Catt, the older generation, who's more accommodationist, work with the system, which is surprising because people don't see me that way, and yet I was. And what we learned from the suffrage movement in America is that it took both. The older generation, the Carrie Chapman Catts, couldn't do it by themselves through assimilation and working in the system. And the younger, radical ones who were pushing the boundaries from the outside couldn't do it by themselves either. It took both. And working together, which is interesting. I had one more comment about your question, Brent, regarding birth control and motherhood. And it would be nice if all members of the church were a little more informed on that. I did a research paper I presented at Sunstone back in 2001, shortly after the church handbook policy changed in 1999. And I researched the history of birth control and rhetoric about birth control, and including a wonderful article that you and I both remember, Jeff Keller, who did it on when does the spirit enter the body? He wrote that back in the 80s, I think, for Dialogue. Anyway, the result of Jeff Keller's work in my paper was that the official rhetoric is all over the map. On when the spirit enters the body, church leaders have said it was anywhere from conception to a day before birth, citing that passage in the Book of Mormon where Christ says, on the morrow come I into the world. So church leaders have said that the spirit enters the body, it could be at any point. Different church leaders have cited different points everywhere from conception to day before birth. And on birth control, the rhetoric on birth control, whether women can use it or should use it, again, has changed drastically from the turn of the century to 1999. Joseph F. Smith was saying no birth control under any circumstances at any time. That changed and church rhetoric was a response to what was happening in the women's movement. That was really a response to the emergence of birth control among American women. In the 60s, the rhetoric spiked again in response to the pill. and rhetoric changed again, but it evolved so that by 1999 in the church policy handbook of policy and procedures, it had evolved to the point where the church policy said how many children to have is a private decision for the couple alone, and church members should not counsel each other in this matter. Now, I haven't seen the latest church policy manual. I don't know if it's backtracked, but that was the most liberal.
I think it's essentially the same.
Is it the same?
Okay. Did you want to comment on that?
And there was a talk
okay.
in general conference, just this last general conference.
Oh, so there was a talk at this last general conference, which I missed.
It was an end. We had that talk, and it was very specific. Not about birth control,
but about
the number of children that you
had. Is a personal choice?
Yes.
Okay, so we have another church talk in our last conference saying that the number of children is a personal choice. When I researched this, I interviewed dozens of women about and men about how many children they had and why and how they feel now. And it was fascinating. So I need to publish that. But anyway, back to that.
I have a question for Natalie, but in response to the other, I would say, great, I'm glad we have a church that adapts to better understanding, you know, rather than being stuck on something from 200 or 300 years ago that's just inflexible.
Mm-hmm.
My question for Natalie is, when you use the word Marxist, I wonder if you use that glibly or what. When I think of Marxism, I think of Mao, for example, in the early 50s, who said they had a few hundred thousand too many women in China and they'd be glad to send some over to the United States. Just as if they were sending Lord feet of lumber or something. But what kind of feminism is that? And when I think about other things, like, you know, in the mid-30s, the number of U.S. intellectuals who were converted to communist way of thinking decided to go over to paradise in the Soviet Union, and all of them were shot within about 2 years. So what sort of feminism might that have been?
I think the label Marxist is a really loaded term, certainly. It is one that I adopt myself because having studied the words of Marx, the way I understand the world and the way I understand why things happen and the way things happen lends a lot to the works of Marx and his understanding of the world. That does not mean I align myself with every movement that has called itself Marxist throughout history.
Has there been a country in the world that's successfully taught those principles and brought them out without leading some sort of authoritarian dictatorship?
Possibly not. Whether the merits of each country that has adopted communism, I think, can be debated widely. I think there are examples of countries who have adopted Marxist principles that have not necessarily led to dictatorships or the kind of Stalinesque massacres that people most commonly associate with it. But I think that there's a lot of... I don't know if you can cut me off, this is totally irrelevant, but I like to think of Marx in three categories. We have Marx the economist, Marx the prophet, and Marx the sociologist. And the one that people usually take offense at that caused all these problems is usually Marx the prophet. Marx predicting how the working class needs to rise up and what that looks like. And also a very Leninist interpretation of Marx, which is that the vanguard of the proletariat needs to become a dictatorship. But I think there are a lot of values in Marx the sociologist and Marx the economist that describe a lot of things that I find very useful for feminism. And there's a lot of feminist thinkers that are very
I can add something to that. Maybe this will
thanks, Ellen. Maybe this will help. When we talk about different feminist movements, Marxist feminists or socialist feminists, these are feminist ideologies that are not necessarily, although they can be part of the particular movement, but they are responding to different cultural times and movements. So liberal feminism in the 17 and 1800s in England and in this country, cultural feminism in the 1800s, socialist feminism, these are specific feminist responses to the movements and cultures and times using ideas from those things. Okay, Mike, you...
Well, I was going to just follow up. Just like there are no countries that you can point to as successful examples of living out Marxist ideals, and likewise, I think you'd have to agree that there are no real Christian nations that have been successful that have ever really tried to live out actual Christian ideals.
Or utopian ideals. I mean, Mormonism, it has a strong socialist bent in its utopianism, and has it succeeded in that way? I'm not sure.
So, somebody once asked Gandhi if he thought it was a good idea to build Western culture, Western countries, on Christian values, and his response was that it was an interesting notion and somebody should try it.
That's great. Okay, we had some more over there. Go ahead.
Because I think, you know, sort of back to the birth rate issue, you know, I can think of, you know, I have two kids, the door's kind of closing on, I think it's going to be two. and this is not just a Mormon situation, this is true probably universally. A lot of families that do have, you know, you mobilize a lot of people to have seven and eight kids and they stay loyal, and I think even my two kids, maybe there might, even just knowing how we approach parenting, be a 50% hit rate of sticking with the church. I mean, I hope they both do, but maybe they won't, or maybe none of them will. And yet, if you have eight who are loyal, and you have hundreds of thousands or millions of people having four or five or six or seven or eight, they stay loyal, you kind of feel like, oh, I don't know how my teaching my two children can make a difference in their lives. But it seems like when I hear people trying to change not just their own children's lives, but change the world, I think, oh, I can only affect my two children's lives. I don't know how it's going to ever change more than that. Do you ever feel kind of this, I don't know, that it's not possible, or that you get down about that?
Let me just reiterate the question a little bit. Asking, I guess, primarily about how you sort of keep your hope that you can make any sort of change. Just, I think especially, you're bringing motherhood into it a lot, teaching your own kids, and how much of a difference can that really make? I mean, I don't know. I worry about that all the time, and I don't even have kids yet. I worry about it frequently, especially because my husband and I approach religion so differently. I'm like, our kids are going to be so messed up, and they're not going to have any sort of handrail to hold on to when it comes to understanding church and how church will work for them if it does. But I guess maybe this is really irresponsible of me, but I don't think about I don't think about changing the world that much. And I don't even really think about changing the church that much. I guess I'm just a little bit more selfish and just hoping that I will be happy and trying to do things that will promote my own happiness, and knowing that I am intrinsically a very caring person who cares about other people's happiness as well. And so I want to promote that too. And I guess it can kind of be attributed to that thing that you see on like motivational posters sometimes. It's so trite and cliche by now, but you know, you change yourself and you can change your family, and then your family can change your community, and your community can change. I mean, I think it does have a ripple effect, but even if that ripple effect doesn't manifest the way we hope, I guess that's just not my focus. My focus is just trying to have my own relationship with God.
This is a topic that I deal with regularly. There are periods where all of my effort, in the many ways that I put forth effort to change the world, I get discouraged, and I sometimes take a couple weeks off. and I realize that I have to own it and embrace it when I feel that way. And just say, I can overdo it. And when I feel like I need to take a break, I will just take a break. And know that after a certain point, I get a little existential if I don't go back and keep trying. I was just recently given a blessing where I was told that my efforts with my children would make a difference in their lives, and that their lives would make a difference in the world. And that was such an amazing promise. I do believe that my husband wouldn't say that just because he wanted me to hear it. I believe that was my parents in heaven telling me something that was going to be something I would cling on to and hold on to for the rest of my life, that I have a promise that somehow my children are going to be positively impacted by my efforts with them and in the world. And so that's kind of how I answer it from a personal perspective. And other than that, I just believe in being gentle with ourselves and knowing what we can take on and accepting our limitations. And being at peace with that, but at the same time, constantly asking, is this what I'm supposed to be doing, and is there more? And it's that balance, finding it personally within yourself. And I recognize that not all women can take on everything. And then sometimes I take on too much. And I step back, and I have lovely, supportive family members who say, you're taking on too much.
Blaine, I saw your hand.
Natalie, did you want to
say something? Yeah, you had. I was just going to briefly answer that. I have gone through really, I've gone through dark periods where I'm like, my efforts are futile, this is never going to work, the bad guys always win. And I've treated myself of that by studying history, because everything I've ever thought or said that I thought was groundbreaking or interesting, somebody has fought for it, somebody has died for it. So you're not alone. Even if you do fail, even if your efforts are extinguished, you don't accomplish anything, somebody else is still fighting that. Somebody else is still feeling that and pushing that, and that tension is never going to disappear.
I was just struck by the quality of Jenny's comments, that she was saying a number of things that were verbatim what Julie Beck said in her talk. And again, it just makes me think of my interpretation of Julie's talk is that she's asking women to open up to the power of God and really open up to it. I mean, really experience it in a way that transforms their lives. Somebody else had a question in the back?
Well, just a comment on what you're talking about, two things. One, when it comes to changing the world, my life has a lot to do with people changing themselves, their own lives, and global recovery. And the answer is pretty much the same in both places. Yes, change happens, and it happens immediately, and it happens irrevocably. But it also never quite works out the way you think it will when you start it. Mm-hmm. The other thing when it comes to raising your children and looking at this from a slightly different perspective, you never stop being the parent. You never stop having that relationship with your children, but by the same token, you never stop being the child. So what you can give today, give. But understand that when they get to your age, you may have a whole different thing to give. You may be in a whole different place than you are now. Mm-hmm. So it's part of that being gentle with yourself. Be gentle with yourself in the past and the future too. Because mm-hmm. you may be somebody that you don't think you're going to be. And it may be exactly what you need to be.
I like those comments about changing yourself, focusing on changing yourself, and also you never stop being a parent and you never stop being a child. I always think of Gandhi's quote, be the change that you want to see in the world. Anybody else have any comments to what he said? Or okay, comment over here.
Oh, sorry, not a comment. Question.
Oh, question.
actually, I wish I could hear this from everyone in the room, not just you guys. But I heard a lot about staying in the church and being forced for change. And then I also hear about individual happiness and doing what you need to do. So how do you balance that tension between wanting to stay because the church needs people like us and getting so frustrated that you want to just drop the mic and walk away, and feeling like that would be happier, that would make you happier?
Is that directed to all three or
everybody?
Everybody in the world.
All
no, and. I mean, yeah, the question of why you stay and how you keep on staying when it's hard is, I mean, that just gets recycled in my life. I don't know about you guys, but. And I can say that I used to read the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teens, a lot. And there was some part in it, I can't remember which habit this was sort of under, but it talked about how you... having an outside motivation to make some sort of decision or important change in your life usually isn't enough. It really needs to come from the inside, which is, you know, an example would be like, oh, everyone in my family wants me to stop smoking, so I guess I will. Like, sometimes that motivation, it just doesn't ring true, because when you're in your darkest moments, you're only relying on yourself. And so when it comes to staying in the church in order to be a force for positive change, like, I have probably 10 to 20 reasons that I could really list out as to why I stay in the church, and all the ones that have to do with other people are really towards the bottom. Other people that I know and love, my family, other people that are hypothetical that I might serve someday, like, they're important to me, but honestly, it's so selfish again, but I guess we all need to be a little bit selfish. Those reasons are not anywhere near as important to me as the fact that I stay in the church because I want to, and I feel like it's exactly what my heavenly parents want me to do. And if I didn't feel that way, I hope I would have enough integrity to somehow negotiate myself out or negotiate myself into living a more authentic life. But I will also say that within that tension of, oh, I kind of want to leave because this is crazy right now and I cannot handle another Relief Society lesson like that. You know, like, having the tension between that and also the wonderful feelings of the Holy Ghost that come in the church for me, they make me happy. Like, the reason that I can stay, it's because I kind of like that tension and I feel like it helps me. And if the tension is too great for other people, I don't think it's good to sacrifice your own well-being on the state, on the altar of, well, but maybe I'll help somebody else someday.
I do a little bit of live and let live. That I mentioned this in when I meet a dead end, I work around it. And there have been a number of times feeling like a woman in the church that I have met a dead end, that my authentic happiness, my living to be fully me, will not occur in the church, and so I've had to take detours and do other things. Birthing in Zion is an example of that. I knew that I was never going to be able to work with church leaders to get that to happen, or I'd be waiting a very long time for it. Same thing for the Women's Service Mission, a social justice arm of the Relief Society, that I'm just going to do it. And so I just said, okay, I looked at my options and said, okay, I can try to work with the church and try to make it happen and maybe be 80 when it happens, or I can just start at a grassroots level and do it now. And the same thing works with God's spirituality in my life, that if I don't find it in the church, I look elsewhere. Maxine is a tremendous example to me that she found it in Gnosticism. And I'm so glad that Jenny Brighton was mentioned, that she's finding it in paganism. And so I find how truth can be circumscribed into one great whole can be found. You can center yourself in the church and pull from where you need to make it home. And it's only been recently, just in time for my 10-year anniversary, that I was able to say, I feel like I'm home. But I wouldn't feel like I'm home without Sunstone, without FMH, without this community. And so I just, like I said, I live and I let live. So I do my thing, I live my happiness, I find my happiness, and I accept the church for where it is, and hope that it will change, and recognize that if it doesn't, that's fine, I'm happy.
I think that's a really complicated question, too. I stay, ultimately, right now, I stay because I think I'm, like, ethnically Mormon. Mormon, for me, is an ethnicity. Like, and my beliefs have been smashed into a million pieces. And some days I think, yeah, okay, I believe. And some days I think, no, not a bit of it. And the thing that never changes is that, like, I still, like, I have this crazy impulse to go to church and talk about Mormonism and write about Mormonism and obsess about Mormonism all the time. And I just can't get it out of my system. You know, if I just stopped caring about it, that would be the time for me to say, like, okay, now it's time for me to go. But I haven't reached that point yet. And I think, so, you know, everybody's at, I guess my definition of a church, too, is I take, I'm really along that competitive square that we saw in the earlier presentation. It's my church. It's my theology. Like, this church is the people in it, and I'm one of those people. And it needs to be comfortable for people like me. Like, I need to be creating a comfortable place for people like me. So I guess because I'm a kind of combative person by nature, if I'm not comfortable somewhere, I take that as a sign that I need to be doing more to make it a place that I do feel comfortable. But I do agree that if I ever got to the point where I didn't fill this pole anymore, like if somehow the Mormonism was ever taken out of me, that's just been with me since birth, you know, then maybe I wouldn't need to stay. I don't think you should sacrifice yourself and sacrifice your happiness for the sake of like enlightening others, because I think if you are sucked of happiness and positivity, you're not going to be giving that to anybody else, and you're not going to be a source of inspiration for anybody else.
Sorry, I'm glad that I can add this, that I in my relationships with people who have struggled with the church, I recognize that there are times when it's necessary to just step away and to take that break. Like, I have my existential weeks. I think that that also applies to the church, and that there may be a time when I just have to say, for my own mental health and my own sense of stability and security, I need to take a break. There are times when I don't go to the LDS church, I don't go to my ward, because I need to supplement it with something else. And I've found some spiritual communities that are supplements. I don't really feel at home there, but it's what I kind of imagine. If this could be in my ward, it would be awesome. And the other thing that I would say is, really, I try to be the change that I can in my ward, and I try to be that voice for the others, the other Mormons. There was she walked right into it too, a Relief Society lesson, where she said, what are some of the things that keep women out of the temple? And I said, ooh, some of the doctrinal issues? And my state president was sitting next to me. and that was my time to really give voice to these valid concerns of women that are just ignored, that there is no home for them in Relief Society to talk about. And so I said, I'm going to do it. And everyone went quiet, and my state president said, those are good questions. And I wanted to hug him. I think I did hug him later.
That's great.
I so admire and honor Jenny and Sarah and Natalie for the ways that they model feminist theology as members, and for claiming their membership. Who is the church? Who is the body of Christ? It's all of us. The kingdom of God is within you, and it's all around you. The kingdom is spread out upon all. And so, living the divine within you, the power of God within you, and the ways that you're doing is doing it. I have a whole new testimony of lay priesthood after being excommunicated for feminist theology and going on a Gnostic initiation path and studying Christian liturgy and sacramental Christianity and coming all the way back around. I think lay priesthood is more powerful. And I think that Joseph Smith was not only instituting lay priesthood, but lay high priesthood, which is an interesting discussion. I want to thank our bishops, Mary Ellen Robertson and Michael Stevens, who are the bishops of Sunstone, who role model a bishop brick beautifully, for shepherding and mentoring a household of faith, and for giving also a secular public place for people like me to sort out issues of feminist theology, and people like us to talk about scholarly and feminist issues outside of the church in a secular setting. Thank you so much. And I guess we need to break for lunch. Okay. Thank you.